It's hard to get someone to do the right thing when their paycheck depends on them doing the wrong thing. Upton Sinclair.
Chapter 2. Communication. Tuesday morning, 11:11 a.m. She's here to cancel.
Are you who I see to cancel my gap?
She asked me. I said, I'll be happy to help you, and I pulled up her deal. It's only been 3 days, and she's refinanced with her credit union, and she bought their gap. She tells me that they were a half point lower, and that this will save her $11 a month. Then a story about how every little bit counts. I think to ask her, does their gap cover 150% a book and her deductible up to $1,000? But she doesn't know what it covers. And worse, she's become a little embarrassed by not knowing what she's actually bought. This one question causes her mood to change, and suddenly she's in a hurry to leave. Now, I know why the situation is falling apart. Her feelings got a little bit hurt by the embarrassment of not knowing if she made the right decision. For a second, she felt a small level of shame in her gut about trusting the credit union. But then, to feel better, she internally told herself the warm fuzzy story that it's okay, and how the credit union are the good guys and I'm the bad guy. Then she left, not knowing if she has 120% or 150% gap coverage. And most likely the new responsibility of paying a $500 deductible if she has a claim. In my world, I asked her a legitimate question about specific coverage on a legal contract. In her world, she felt offended. She framed me as a jerk. Perception is reality, I guess. Still, I suspect I could have possibly saved the products, the financing, and the CSI had I connected with her differently. The trust alarm. He screamed, "Let's get out of here now." Quickly, all the firefighters followed the chief outside. Moments later, the floor collapsed. They all would have died had they stayed inside. Afterwards, a reporter asked the chief how he knew to run. "I didn't even know I said anything," the chief responded. "It was all subconscious." Sometimes this is what people refer to as a sixth sense, also known as knowledge that you did not receive from sight, smell, touch, sound, or taste. This is information that comes from somewhere else. We regularly refer to this as a gut feeling. So, where does the gut feeling come from? In the chief's case, it came by little things, like his ears burning from the abnormal amount of heat and from the fire being too quiet. In the moment, he was not consciously aware of his ears burning or the odd quietness, but he could recall these details after the fact. His crew thought they were trying to put out a small kitchen fire, but their water didn't seem to have the usual effect. Turns out the actual fire was underneath them, in the basement. Even though the chief didn't consciously know the fire was in the basement at the time, his gut instinct, based on data and prior life experience, told his subconscious to run. So he made the call to leave the house. In the box, you will meet customers that also have a sixth sense. If they feel a situation is unsafe, like dealing with somebody that is only focused on making money, they're going to run. If you're sending this message to your customer that you're only there for you and you're only thinking about your PVR, you're going to have a tough time if their gut tells them not to buy or to be careful. At a minimum, the customer is going to withhold their trust from you. Once you lose trust, you're not likely to sell them anything. Now, we can call it the trust alarm, our sixth sense, or just plain old anxiety. Some people come in with their defenses up, right? So, we spend a lot of time learning how to close. We dig deep into the sales training handbook in order to overcome their objections. Customers do something similar. They often create strategies for saying no. Picture a husband and wife simply out kicking tires with a commitment between each other that no matter what, they will not buy today. They plot out a story beforehand about refinancing their house or some other bogus reason with the intention of lying to the salesperson as to why they cannot buy today. Why would they do that? They're not alone. Consider a telemarketer. Have you ever said that you didn't have time when you did? Why would a customer plot to lie beforehand? Is it possible that they are afraid of us? In a recent Gallup poll on ethics, we find car people are at the bottom of the list below lawyers and members of Congress. So maybe they are afraid of us. It seems that years of dysfunctional sales practices have led to dysfunctional buying practices. This begs the question, does the customer's anxiety play a major part in the sales process? Absolutely. When people are nervous, they don't focus well. Sometimes they won't even comprehend or understand your products or your presentations. Being trustworthy. We live in a world full of locks. Your door's locked, your car's locked, your computer's locked, your phone's locked. Don't forget to lock up when you leave. And the list goes on. We are conditioned not to trust, but we still wish that we could. Thousands of years ago, we had to band together to survive. The world was a pretty wild place, and we were on the menu for all kinds of predators. We survived through teamwork. You sleep, and I'll watch out for threats. My ancestors and yours needed to cooperate with each other by protecting food, sharing resources, and guarding against predators. They had to trust each other, or they would die. And they did trust each other. Otherwise, you and I wouldn't be here today. Basically, 100% of our ancestors lived long enough to mate and reproduce because of one thing: trust. Without trust, mankind simply would not exist. So, how do we develop trust with our clients and our coworkers as well as our friends and our family? We must walk the walk. We must behave with the qualities of self-trust. When we trust ourselves, people around us see it and feel it. It's that simple. The possibility of possibility. Choice is linked to risk, and risk provokes anxiety. So being in the situation of having to decide on something like a vehicle service contract right now can create varying levels of anxiety for people. Anxiety is actually a survival tool. Emphasis on the word tool. It's a resource and not something to fear. It's valuable for making sure that you make smart business decisions, like when you're buying a car. It's responsible for the gut feeling you get warning you to slow down or to proceed with caution. When you come to realize its functional use as a tool and nothing more, then you can understand the value of it. Anxiety lives in one little part of the brain called the amygdala. Its primary job is to decide what is and isn't safe. If something seems unsafe, it begins the fight or flight process. Once that happens, people will begin to tune out, begin delaying on decisions, or worse, they'll argue with you and then frame you as being a pushy jerk. Fortunately, getting past the customer's anxiety is within your power. By establishing trust, you will be able to communicate through your customer's anxiety, which is super important if you hope to discuss the value of your products.
Anxiety is the price we pay for the human ability to choose. Soren Kierkegaard.
Building trust. Have you ever seen The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, Jay Leno, or Jimmy Fallon? Are you familiar with the opening monologue? You know, the part where he speaks to the audience about current events and makes jokes? Notice, it's not a conversation. He is speaking to them, but they rarely ever speak back. This is a monologue. In Latin, mono stands for one. One person is talking here, which is perfect for comedy, but not so hot for sales transactions. We need to establish a dialogue, or more specifically, a two-way conversation, if we hope to effectively communicate ideas and feelings with our customers. In Latin, the word dia means to penetrate through. For us, we need to penetrate through all the preconceived ideas that our customers arrived with and show them that we are not what they expected. It's the only way that we can prove we are not just another salesperson. For this to happen, we will be working with our customers in two different areas: the thinking self, which controls logic and competency, and the feeling self, which controls character and ethics. On the thinking self, it is our ability to create a feeling of safety for our customers in a way that allows them to speak freely about their concerns. It is our professionalism. It is our knowledge base. It is where logic and problem solving live. It is our technique and our competency. Our problem solving skills are necessary if we hope to create the best ownership experience for our customers. In our case, it means not only understanding the lenders, the laws, and the products, but also having the ability to apply critical thought to your customers' needs, then discussing the right product mix that creates the best ownership experience for them. You can be the most well-intentioned person in the world, an honest person in every way, but if you cannot demonstrate with competency how a product helps, you will not be successful. So, if we're going to be effective and help our customers achieve the best ownership experience, we need the ability to communicate in a way that helps people quickly recognize our level of professionalism and competency. On the feeling self, this is what we refer to as a gut feeling. It is the desire to be fair. It is our ability to feel empathy for others. It is where love, art, and passion originate. It is doing the right thing. It is our intent. It's our purpose. It is our character. A good deal of the material F&I managers learn during F&I training are designed for the thinking self. Techniques like word tracks and closes are about making people think, but if those techniques do not serve your intent, your purpose, your character, then everything that you do will seem inauthentic or salesy. It will merely be a manipulation. If our feeling self fails to connect, then our customers won't open up and communicate with us. Transparency will diminish, and it's unlikely that they will ever feel safe enough to trust us. They will believe that there are zero reasons to buy what you're trying to sell them. Even when the benefits of the product are clear, the customer will still say no. On the other hand, if we can connect and our customers are comfortable and open and honest with us, then we will have a chance. Putting the thinking and feeling self together. So let's say that we connect. Your feeling self has formed an opinion that I'm a pretty good person, and yet I fail to bring enough intellectual rigor to justify why you could benefit from a product that I'm offering. Then you'll still say no. So when taking the time to build or construct your dialogue with the customers, we want to work on both dimensions, thinking and feeling, if we hope to inspire trust. The first dimension is using our feeling self by being transparent in our communication and showing our true intent is to offer and discuss products that truly help. This is grounded in our belief in those products and our ability to highly endorse those products. The second dimension is using our thinking self by showing our competency, our knowledge, as it relates to our products, knowing and showing exactly how the proposed product helps people. To be more concise, we must be knowledgeable and show good intent if we hope to generate trust. Our product knowledge and closing skills are worthless if we can't get past the customer's gut feeling, the feeling that is causing them to stall in the first place. And our good intentions are worthless if we don't understand how the products actually solve their problems. Can you be trusted? When you display both your thinking and feeling self, people will let their guard down and let you in. This is the beginning of trust. There's a dynamic at play here between our head and our gut. Our brain recognizes competency, understands data, and makes data judgments based on what can be seen. However, our gut makes decisions on what can be felt. So, while I may understand that the VSE coverage will only add $7 a month to my payment, my gut is telling me that something is off. It feels too cheap. So I ask, how much does it cost? F&I answers, it's only $7 per month. Zero hard data was still given. I actually want to know the cost. But instead, we are creating a bottleneck in the flow of communication and reducing trust in our transaction. The head and the gut, or the thinking and feeling selves, work together to make decisions. But it's usually the gut, or the feeling self, that wins. And then the thinking self goes on to construct a story to justify the decision that the feeling self has just made. We see this in relationships. The heart wants what the heart wants. The head knows the likelihood for success isn't ideal, but we can't help being with the person that we want anyway because it's what we want. Yet we don't even know why. The same thing happens in transactions. We make the decisions with our gut about trust, and then we move forward. Sometimes even when our heads point out obvious roadblocks. Sometimes we tell ourselves the story that he or she means well and that they were just mistaken because we are so invested in the way that something felt. In the box, we must find congruence with our beliefs. We must be real and authentic. In order to inspire belief, we must believe in the products that we offer and understand exactly how they will help. If we don't, people will feel it in their gut and they will say no. They will feel like we cannot be trusted and they will be right. In short, character comes from your gut. It is the belief that someone will do the right thing. Competency, on the other hand, comes from our head, and it is the belief that someone knows what they are doing. Without this combination, you will find difficulty creating long-term success. Competency. Knowledge is knowing that you know how to do things correctly. It's technical. Do you know your stuff, or are you winging it? Ask yourself, have you ever actually read the fine print on the contracts that you sell to people? Do you understand how the contracts work? How hard is it to file a claim? In short, ask yourself if you're an expert on your products and your job. I hope you are. We display our competency by understanding how we can help our customers have the best ownership experience. Also, by understanding how we can help people avoid economic and financial hardships. This requires that you slow down and ask questions when you don't fully understand something. Maybe pick up the phone and call the product provider and see how the claims process works. Maybe even speak with your service advisors. The key point is to learn everything about what you sell, how it works, and how it helps. When you meet people, they are immediately going to begin making judgments about who you are and thinking, can I trust this person? Having confidence helps a lot. Most people develop confidence from experience. If you skip this part, you cannot be an expert. But there's a big plus side to digging in and fully understanding your products. Competency is the cornerstone of confidence, and confidence inspires trust. Character. Recognizing right from wrong, then choosing right, is the foundation of character. Everyone's moral compass is different, but having good intent is still the same. Like the Golden Rule says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Matthew 7:12. Basically, treat people like you'd like to be treated. This does not mean losing profits. All businesses have revenue goals and must create profit to exist, but you do not need to lie or deceive to create it. Display your character by being fair, by also thinking about your customer's agenda too. Ask yourself, is this offer fair? Would I buy at these terms, or would I advise a friend or family member to buy under these conditions? Again, we must be profitable. I want to be crystal clear. Businesses have revenue goals, and you will have personal revenue goals. Go after them. Just don't lose your ethics or self-esteem in the process. Anytime a customer asks you, how much is it? You should be able to look them directly in the eye and answer. But if you feel the urge to hide the truth, it is a sign that you're not feeling comfortable. As a result, your body language, your vocal tone, and your eye movement will begin to betray you.
When we are being inauthentic, our nonverbal and verbal behaviors begin to misalign. Our facial expressions don't match the words we're saying. Our postures are out of sync with our voices. They no longer move in harmony with each other. They disintegrate into cacophony. Amy Cuddy.
Is it in our DNA to lie or tell the truth? Coco was a gorilla that was born in captivity, and she learned how to interact with humans through sign language. As an adult, she was given a kitten. One day, while angry, Coco ripped the sink out of the wall and then blamed it on the kitten. We can assume she saw lying as her only defense when the researchers asked her what happened. A lie is basically a psychological self-defense. We've all done it. We're just trying to use our intellectual tools to protect ourselves. But we never really feel good about lying, do we? No. People that lie and feel good about it are called psychopaths. Most of us empathize simply because we don't want to be lied to ourselves. Yellow lights. Imagine if we connected with people before we discussed products. Is it at least a possibility our conversations could go differently? Maybe not all the time, but a certain percentage of the time. One way of seeing this is asking yourself, how can I be more than just another salesperson in their eyes? Is it possible that you could slow down, be completely authentic, and become the most positive part of their day? Could you possibly get a real smile from them? Could you maybe add so much value that they leave with respect for your knowledge and professionalism? Now, this will not occur if you're in a hurry. In fact, this may seem counterintuitive, but it's okay to slow down when you see yellow lights. Yes, I know the next customer is waiting and the sales manager is staring at you through the window. It's added pressure, but let's consider the transaction from a couple different angles. From the perspective of the dealership itself, like any business, profit is its lifeblood. So making a profit and keeping it are super important. The better transaction we have with the customer, the better chance they have of understanding the value of our products. This leads to more sales and lower chargebacks. What about from the perspective of the customer? It is at least a possibility that they might want to have a nice experience with you. Is it possible that they might want something to go right in their lives and it's supposed to be this car? With that in mind, ask yourself, how can I use my communication skills to improve their day, my day, and meet my dealership's goals? Answer that question and you immediately become a better F&I manager. Stop worrying about the transaction times. If you're a profitable team player, you'll earn the freedom to discuss changes that will speed up the transaction process. I can prove it. Increase your PVR and see how quickly your GM and your sales managers forgive the extra few minutes with your customer. But soon, there won't be any extra time to worry about. Because when we inspire trust in people, they say yes earlier in the transaction. So, let's address the hurry that everybody seems to be feeling. The interesting thing that everybody seems to be missing is twofold. Number one, the reason the customer is in a hurry is because they are no longer enjoying the process. Make it enjoyable, and that hurry begins to evaporate. As they say, time flies when you're having fun. Number two, the reason the transaction is taking too long is because of the lack of trust. If you can silence the trust alarm, the process will speed up. If you set it off, the process will slow down. It's that simple. If the customer doesn't trust you or your product or fears being ripped off, everything's going to go slowly. If the salesperson on deck doesn't trust you'll spin the deal quick enough and his customer will change their mind, it's going to seem too long. If the sales manager took a short deal and doesn't trust your ability to make it up on the back, he will fear having to explain why he took a short deal. Basically, when we have an overall lack of trust, it always creates fear. Have you ever had someone read the fine print on every form? This is an extreme lack of trust. This is a yellow light. So slow down and address it. Be authentic. Ask them if they've had a bad experience in the past. Then promise to be completely honest and slow down and do what you can to make it comfortable for them. Change their perception of car people by genuinely showing that you care. Bring your character and your competency, your knowledge and your integrity, your head and your gut, your thinking and your feeling self to the customer, and the process will quicken. Perception is reality. 88% of Americans believe that they have superior driving skills compared to most. Obviously, this cannot be true. People in general feel their skill level is above average in leadership skills, personal health, and ethics, just to name a few. In a strange twist, the less qualified people are, the more confident they tend to be. This is referred to as the Dunning-Kruger effect. Discovered in 1999, it hypothesized that people are confused in two ways. First, they often fail at skills. Second, they lack the understanding to clearly understand their cause of failure. Once people slow down to educate themselves, they're pretty quick to admit their mistakes. It's just that most people don't take the time to educate. On the other hand, smart people make the mistake of thinking everyone else is equally as smart. This too has the same effect of creating an inaccurate self-image. If you're too dumb, you can't understand how you're wrong. If you're too smart, you can't understand that other people don't understand you. These are all beliefs, which is a very strange thing. If we don't believe anything bad is ever going to happen to us, it's going to be pretty hard to convince us to prepare for it. If I don't believe I'll ever use your product, I'm going to have a hard time buying it. In order to inspire change, you must believe in change. Belief is a two-way street. Nobody is going to believe you if you don't believe yourself. A lack in your self-confidence is something that other people will feel. If you're lacking confidence, people will notice. What determines our level of self-esteem is in direct relationship with our habits and our principles. Having the discipline of acting a certain way to achieve your goals builds it up. Ignoring the work of living by your principles destroys it. You must live in accordance with your beliefs if you wish to be credible. In the box, this means that you also must see the value in the same products that you sell. Types of truth. When we are trying to create trust, it is assumed that we must discuss the truth. I mean, how else can you trust someone if you're not telling the truth? But what is the truth? Is it always the truth that someone needs the product that you're offering them? Probably not. But you have economic goals, so you're probably going to ask for the sale even when you're not sure if they need it. But how do you know? Even the smartest person in the world cannot predict with certainty what the future holds. Ultimately, we are working with two different types of truth: absolute truth and believed truth. An example of absolute truth is gravity. Gravity doesn't care if you believe in it. Gravity is always there whether you want it or not. Money, however, is not absolute. It is believed. We all agree that it has value, and if our values changed, so would its value. Money can feed you, but you cannot eat it. If the belief in money's value changes, it could become worthless. Its utility comes from our mutual belief in its value. Likewise, with the products that we offer, we are never working with absolute truth, only believed truth. Will the car break down? Who knows? Will having the coverage make you feel better while you own it? I think we can all agree that it will. Conversation is not comprehension. We usually don't know much about our customers. We don't know their needs. We don't have much time to explore their driving habits or their ownership goals. So we often end up wondering what we can sell them as opposed to understanding their actual situation. Maybe we subscribe to the 300% rule. Offer them everything, hope they bite on something. In short, we guess. Why? Reason number one, we fear that we will kill the deal by taking too long. Reason number two, we fear engaging in conversation because we may look uninformed on our products. Reason number three, we skip trying to understand people because it's just easier to offer everything. Unfortunately, the more that we guess, the more likely that we are going to be wrong. If our goal is really about helping our customers have the best ownership experience, then we have the right and the obligation not to simply guess. We often mistake conversation with comprehension. We assume that because we understand what something means to us, that it must mean the same to everyone else too. To avoid guessing, we need to listen carefully to the words and phrases that our customers use and then ask them what those words and phrases mean to them. In other words, clarify. Here's an example of a pattern that I like to use when I'm trying to clarify information with somebody. Customer says, "I don't want a high interest rate." I would reply with, "If I asked 10 different people what they considered high, I'd get 10 different answers. May I ask what high means to you?" Customer replies, "Well, my credit union's at blank percent," or "I don't want to pay more than I did on my last car, which was blank percent," or "I don't know, probably blank." Sometimes, when we ask the customer to clarify their words, we learn something that we didn't expect. And that something can be even more valuable than we anticipated. Framing your conversation. Unless you're working for the power company or the DMV, you're not going to sell everyone. In order to sell more often, you'll need to model your pitch to your audience. For instance, if your customer is very affluent, then a product that provides budget protection may not seem very important to them. However, the same product discussed from a different point of view could save them time or create comfort. Now, that product might be appealing enough to buy. This is what we refer to as framing. Framing helps people see the benefit as it applies to them. If you're into prestige, I will try and frame my conversation around comfort and convenience. If you're concerned about your budget, then I'll try and frame the conversation about saving you money. Ideally, I'm going to listen to you and then frame the conversation around helping you add comfort, avoid pain, or possibly both. Can we ask the customer, hey, what's important to you? Time? Money? Something else? Yes. Yes, you can. And it will work if it's genuine. The goal here is to be genuine at trying to help your customer have the best experience. Doing that opens up the door to these types of communication. The science of framing, prospect theory. In the box and in life, we sometimes frame things in a way that keeps us or our customer from really understanding the problem. Could the way that we present a product influence the amount of risk a person will choose to take? Yes, it can. And if you've been in F&I for more than a month, you've experienced it. One small phrase, framed negatively, in your presentation can quickly translate into a customer saying no, reflexively. Nobel Prize-winning economist Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky developed a theory about this called prospect theory. It describes how people make decisions, like financial decisions, based on how the information felt, rather than the actual information itself. For instance, if we use risk as a closing tool, like in mechanical breakdown, we are more likely to see the customer adopt a risk-seeking mindset. Instead, if we use benefit as a closing tool, the customer is more likely to adopt a benefit-seeking mindset. Ultimately, a blended approach is often necessary, but I recommend always starting with the benefits. According to Kahneman and Tversky, presenting a problem as a potential loss actually adds momentum to risk-seeking behavior, while framing the situation as a gain adds momentum to risk aversion behavior. Test it. Imagine for a moment that you work in a large dealership with a few hundred other employees. Financially, the store is experiencing some losses, and the general manager has decided that 60 layoffs are necessary. To assist, the general manager and the dealer principal have brought in two outside consulting firms to see if there's any way to save the 60 jobs. ABC Consulting proposes Solution A. If we adopt Solution A, 20 jobs will be saved. They also propose Solution B. Solution B has a 1/3 probability that all jobs will be saved and a 2/3 probability that none of the jobs will be saved. Which one do you favor, A or B? Make a note of it. XYZ Consulting also brings two proposals. Solution C means 40 people will lose their jobs. Solution D has a 1/3 probability that nobody will lose their jobs and a 2/3 probability that everyone will lose their jobs. Again, out of C and D, which one do you favor? Make a note of it. Now that we have your responses, let's examine the typical responses. We've found on average that people answer the first and second question differently. The first question is predominantly answered by risk aversion, solution A. And the second question is predominantly answered by risk-seeking tendencies, solution D. So what's going on? The two situations are basically identical. The questions are statistically the same, but they consistently elicit different answers. The only difference is that the first question focuses on the amount of jobs that might be saved, and the second question focuses on the amount of jobs that might be lost. When we frame the situation as potential gain by using the word saved in solutions A and B, we see people behaving much more risk adverse. When we frame the situation as a potential loss, as in solutions C and D, we see people behaving with more risk-seeking behavior. And the point is that we can see the same person fluctuate from risk-seeking to risk-aversion behavior just because we ask the question differently. We find the way we frame the situation by small changes in our wording or our language directly influences our propensity to take or reject risk. In other words, the way we define the problem dictates the way our customer responds to it. So how does this work in the box? Ask yourself, how often does the all cars break eventually close work on a person buying their fourth Honda because they've never had a problem? Not very well. F&I managers are traditionally taught to close based on loss or risk, mechanical breakdown, or economic hardship. According to prospect theory, framing the purchase as a potential problem encourages the customer to become more of a risk taker. So instead of getting a sale, you get to hear, "Yeah, I'll take my chances." To avoid encouraging risk-seeking behavior, we must talk about benefits and solutions first. Then, only if necessary, discuss the possible loss or risk that you're trying to protect them from experiencing. Good. This is a personal story, but I believe it demonstrates the effectiveness of slowing down for yellow lights and engaging your thinking self, then reframing your view. We lost an important client in January of 2018 that represented a sizable amount of our company's revenue. Immediately, for about 15 minutes after hearing the news, I was stunned. My feeling self was very engaged. Honestly, I never anticipated it. The relationship was leveraged nicely in their favor. We provided a higher level of service than expected, and the relationship was mutually open and helpful. But our client hired a new CEO, and just like hiring a new head coach, he had existing relationships with people that he already liked and trusted. He gave us the axe on his second day without even comparing our companies. I was at a loss, professionally stunned. I had to ask myself, do I frame this new situation as a threat or as an opportunity? I mean, yes, it's a threat to my income and my ego. Both of those make sense. But where are the hidden opportunities? After calming my feeling self down, I spent a few minutes with my thinking self. Then I began to consider this new circumstance from multiple angles. I saw things clearly, and it changed my life in a couple of huge ways. For the last several years, I had been spending about 150 nights a year away from home for this one client. I was traveling endlessly, and I was exhausted. The extra time allowed me to do what I wanted, and I wanted to spend it with the people closest to me. The connection and conversations that I wanted to have with my wife and my children, they were just difficult to acquire. Everyone was always busy, and I was always working or I was gone. I wanted to travel to places other than dealerships for a change. No offense. So, I decided to see the good in the new situation. I bought an RV, and we traveled with my daughter, who just graduated from high school, for a whole year. We had the experience of staying in the Rocky Mountains, just outside of Denver, on a dude ranch in Cheyenne, Wyoming. We floated in the Great Salt Lake of Utah. We were in the deep forest outside of Seattle. We experienced the weirdness of Portland. We stayed for a month on a cliff overlooking the Pacific Ocean in San Francisco. We were in the Redwood Forest outside of Santa Cruz. We were in Hollywood, Las Vegas, and Vancouver, too. We also went to some of the most desolate places in America, like Meteor Crater, the Petrified Forest, the Grand Canyon, the Navajo Nation, and Antelope Canyon. We spent several weeks in each location, and it was great. None of this would have happened without slowing down my feeling self and allowing my thinking self to get to work, stopping the anxiety of the unknown long enough to embrace the new opportunity of working from the road and spending time seeing the country with my family. Truly, it was a once-in-a-lifetime trip.